This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, June 20th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The EKA's cancer rate soars, prompting fears it's linked to U.S. bombings on the island. Your friendly Walmart chain gets slapped with a lawsuit claiming it discriminates against women. And a profile of a man who'll go anywhere to talk about his position on the death penalty. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The tobacco industry has been hit hard by lawsuits finding they misled smokers and continue to make a harmful product. But financially, Big Tobacco is doing just fine, as any stock analyst will tell you. So why is the U.S. Justice Department looking to settle their case? Gareth Schweitzer reports. From D.C.
Justice Department officials have hinted that their own weak case could have affected the decision, although White House spokesman Ari Fleischer would only say that the administration is taking a new approach.
The president does believe that we are much too litigious a society. The Department of Justice is going to proceed on a two-track approach, one involving litigation, the other involving possible settlement talks, and the president supports that approach.
The tobacco control lobby was quick to disagree with this approach, however, including Peter Billings of the American Lung Association.
Obviously, with the budget request that the Justice Department put forward, they were not very serious about pursuing this case. And then to announce, hey, we've got a weak case, we want to settle, really causes us great concern that they're not serious about pursuing the case and the need to do all that is necessary to bring this case to trial and to pursue the racketeering charges against the tobacco industry.
From the White House, I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
The Texas legislature won't meet again for 2 years. And this year, they've got plenty to be mad about over the governor's record number of vetoes. Frieda Worden reports from Austin.
Texas Governor Rick Perry delivered a smashing insult to the Texas legislature on Sunday, vetoing 82 bills. One bill would have asked the federal government to provide Medicaid match for birth control and cancer screening for Texas women with incomes up to $31,000 for a family of four. Current federal guidelines provide for free screening only if the family income is under $3,000. Stunned Texas legislators complained Perry's office had voiced no opinions when the 82 vetoed bills were being forged in compromise between the Republican-controlled Senate and Democratic House. In Austin, Texas, I'm Frieda Worden for Free Speech Radio News.
Farm workers across the U.S. work long hours without breaks or overtime, receive low wages, and are highly exposed to an assortment of harmful chemicals and pesticides. Entering its second day, the Walk for Farm Worker Justice wants to highlight the people who pick our food. Denise Kobolchek reports from Portland, Oregon.
In Oregon, the Walk for Farm Worker Justice began its tour of the Upper Willamette Valley. A coalition of religious, labor, youth, environmental, and human rights organizations are marching in farming areas to show solidarity for field workers. The event includes daily walks, followed by rallies and teach-ins, and organizers plan to end the event this weekend with a big rally in front of NORPAC, one of the largest grower-owned processing cooperatives of frozen fruits and vegetables. They also will converge on the Capitol in Salem, joining thousands of immigrants to protest unfair labor practices. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Denise Kobolchek.
According to the U.S. Committee for Refugees, war and persecution have forced more than 34.5 million people to flee their homes throughout the world. Susan Wood reports on the non-governmental organization from the U.N.
The non-governmental organization says Palestinians, Afghans, Sudanese, and Iraqis account for the largest groups of refugees, those who have crossed an international border. Millions more are displaced within countries like Angola, Colombia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The erosion of the right to asylum is exacerbating their plight, according to Bill Frelick, director of policy for the Refugee Committee, who says undocumented asylum seekers shouldn't be treated like criminals.
We have to understand that there are people that don't have proper travel documents, and there's a good reason for that, because they can't go to their own governments to seek permission to leave, because their own governments are the ones that are seeking to persecute them.
Frelick says the U.S. policy of detaining or deporting undocumented refugees and asylum seekers violates the United Nations Refugee Convention. That treaty, whose 50th anniversary is being honored today, prohibits forcible repatriation of persons facing persecution in their home countries. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Susan Wood at the United Nations.
And finally, NATO military planners are preparing to send approximately 3,000 soldiers to Macedonia to collect arms, saying the troops will have a specific task for a specified period of time. The NATO involvement hinges on whether or not ethnic Albanians in the region will voluntarily disarm. At the moment, talks between the ethnic Albanian minority and Serbian majority are at a standstill. NATO said it could and would act swiftly once an agreement has been reached between the two sides. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Employees at Walmart, the world's largest retailer, are being sued for sex discrimination. The class action lawsuit filed yesterday in the federal district court in San Francisco alleges that the nation's largest employer of women discriminates against its female employees in compensation, job assignments, and promotions. Walmart denies any systematic discrimination, but as Kelly Ramirez reports from San Francisco, women are coming forward with a different story.
With a potential class of over 500,000 current and former female employees of Walmart retail stores, Walmart supercenters, and Sam's Club stores, the suit stands to be the largest sex discrimination case ever litigated against a private employer. Walmart spokesperson Rob Phillips denies that the retail giant discriminates.
Walmart does not condone discrimination of any kind. Women hold positions of significant responsibility at Walmart. They're executive vice presidents, regional vice presidents, senior vice presidents, and assistant general counsels, and they hold other senior level positions.
But according to several named plaintiffs and attorneys who announced the lawsuit in San Francisco yesterday, the first rung on the corporate ladder, the position of store manager, is disproportionately occupied by men. Women, they say, comprise over 72% of Walmart's sales force, but 90% of the store managers are men. Plaintiff Stephanie Odell of Norman, Oklahoma, worked for Walmart from November 1991 to October 1999.
I accepted 11 transfers in 8 years, and I guess you could say I was Walmartized. I gave up my nights, my weekends, my holidays, my vacation, because I believed that I had found a home with Sam's Club. Time and time again, the promotions that I should have had, the jobs that I should have had, were given to men. When I complained to my general manager, I was told, quote, it's a man thing. Then I was reprimanded and forced to move to another city. When I got to that city, I was denied the opportunity to take a skills assessment test that was crucial for promotions. But the male managers that were in my store were allowed to take it. When I questioned my general manager about this, he said, they only sent X amount of tests. Less than 2 weeks later, I was terminated to make room for yet another member of the good old boys club who wanted my job.
Lead plaintiff Betty Dukes, who is currently employed at a Walmart in Pittsburgh, California, described how jobs on the sales floor are segregated by gender.
If you work in the hardware department or if you mix paint, those are the types of positions they seem to move the men around in where they interact with men. And the more of the softer areas in the store when you're dealing with baby clothes and soft lines and a foundational thing, those are the positions that the women seem to dominate in. But I can tell you this, I can mix a can of paint. I want the chance to do it.
The legal complaint alleges that the male-dominated departments and jobs are better paid and offer greater opportunities for advancement than the female-dominated positions and departments. Mickey Earwood of Springfield, Ohio, a Walmart personnel manager for about 2 years, said she witnessed overt acts of pay discrimination.
As an example, if you were to receive a merit raise, which was something that was much more difficult for a woman to come by in my store than a man, they were handed out very much more often and more freely and easily to men. But a merit raise as a standard was given as a percentage. You could only get a certain percentage. That was the standard. And women were told time and time again in my presence, I cannot give you any more than that. That's what the policy is. Many times I saw where a man would ask for a merit raise, and maybe a merit raise based on what he makes, the percentage might come out to 38 cents. He'd be given a dollar, just right off the top, a dollar, which had to be overwrote in the computer, and they knew about it clear to the home office that it was going on.
The plaintiff's attorneys are an ad hoc group drawn from nonprofit public interest and women's legal groups, along with nationally respected private employee rights law firms. They are seeking a court order requiring Walmart to end its discriminatory practices. They also want Walmart to pay the women who have been discriminated against the earnings they should have gotten but for that discrimination. A website, www.walmartclass.com, has been set up for people wanting more information about the suit. The site states that all communications are entirely confidential. There's also a toll-free number, 1-877-WOMAN-WM. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelly O'Romaris in San Francisco.
At least 38 people and Jacqueline Jackson, wife of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, have been detained by the U.S. Navy over protest of the military's bombing on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Bombing of Vieques exercises were to have begun Monday, but demonstrators say their protests have prevented the Navy from beginning its training exercises. At issue is increased cancer rates on Vieques. Activists say 40 years of Navy bombing on the island has leached tremendous amounts of mercury and other heavy metals into the island's soil and groundwater, leading to a cancer rate that's at least 26% higher than the main island of Puerto Rico. More from Shannon Novak in Vieques.
Vieques, Puerto Rico, is the sort of sleepy, lush, tropical island that people in the U.S. dream about all winter long. It's home to some of the Caribbean's finest secluded beaches, and there's even a bioluminescent bay. The deep coral reefs that surround the island attract divers from around the world. Horses roam free, tropical birds are everywhere, and the trade winds, they feel like a kiss. It's hardly the place you would expect to find this.
Terrible contaminants that have been accumulating for over 60 years that include RDX, one of the principal components of conventional explosives, a very insidious chemical component that gets into the biosystems, and also nitrates, nitrites, lots of heavy metals, and the Navy has admitted recently the use of uranium. All of this comes wind-blown to the civilian section and also gets into the food chain through erosion into the ocean. And this, we believe, is one of the explanations for the fact that Vieques has a 26% higher cancer case rate than all of the rest of Puerto Rico.
Robert Rabin is a spokesperson for the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques. That cancer statistic is 10 years old. New studies are underway. Puerto Rico Health Secretary Johnny Urian expects the results this August. The government of Puerto Rico, the University of Puerto Rico, and several independent contractors have done tests on the air, soil, and water and found them contaminated. One study recently done by scientists at the university in Mayagüez, Puerto Rico, found heavy metals in vegetation throughout the island and called it unfit for human and animal consumption. 9,600 residents live in Vieques. Commonwealth tests on the residents' hair, blood, urine, and feces show that same metal contamination. Mercury is the biggest component. The U.S. Navy has done its own studies on the residential area, and they find no health risks in the environment. The U.S. Federal Agency for the Toxic Substance and Disease Registry released a soil study this spring. It concluded no contamination in the soil in the residential area. More federal studies on other possible pathways have been delayed. Many residents and the government of Puerto Rico are also concerned about what they feel to be a high rate of heart abnormalities, diabetes, and asthma. Federal heart studies that have been farmed out to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota have also been delayed. Rear Admiral Kevin Green is the commander for the U.S. Navy's Southern Fleet.
As I've said before on many occasions, if any connection is found between the Navy operations on Vieques and the health of the citizens, then we will change our operations accordingly. We have absolutely no interest in creating, causing, or contributing to bad health effects on our neighbors anywhere where we conduct our operations in the United States.
About contamination in the civilian area, the Navy does not believe Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico does not believe the Navy. Recently, some land held by the Navy was returned to Vieques. This area was used as a place to store ammunition for decades. All parties involved are in agreement about toxic contamination in this section of Vieques. Because of the contamination, it is off limits, but flying over left me with a very eerie feeling. There are large sections of barren land and a long row of warehouses that formerly contained bombs that leaked uranium. Dr. Juan Fernandez is the Vieques commissioner. He's appointed by the government of Puerto Rico to handle Vieques affairs.
This contamination site must be decontaminated by the Navy. That's by federal and by local law, that's the Navy obligation. Even though the lands were returned and we accepted them, the obligation to clean those lands is still on the Navy. But the thing is, when are they going to do that?
There is a somewhat vocal group of Vieques residents who do want the Navy to stay. They are organized by military veterans. Puerto Ricans who live in the Commonwealth cannot vote for the United States president, although if they do take up residence in the states, they can. And Puerto Rico's representative in Washington has a seat in Congress, but no congressional vote. Puerto Ricans are required to register with Selective Services, and if a draft is in effect, they are drafted. Per capita, there is a higher number of Puerto Ricans who volunteer for military service than there is among people in the states. Since April of last year, over 1,000 people have been arrested in Puerto Rico for protesting the Navy's practice maneuvers on Vieques, and in the states, about 100 people have been arrested. Puerto Rico's current government administration remains firm in its demand for the immediate end to all military practices on Vieques, the cleanup of the land, and the return to the municipality of Vieques and the government of Puerto Rico all Navy-held land. In Vieques, Puerto Rico, I'm Shannon Novak, Free Speech Radio News.
Survivors of the massacre of hundreds of Palestinian refugees during Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon have filed criminal charges of genocide and crimes against humanity in Belgium against Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Sharon is being pursued under a 1993 Belgian law which allows war criminals, whatever their nationality and wherever the crimes were committed, to be tried in Belgium. The law, extended in 1999 to cover human rights violations and genocide, strips government ministers of all immunity from prosecution. A 1983 Israeli state inquiry found Sharon, then the defense minister, indirectly responsible for the killing of hundreds of Palestinian men, women, and children at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. The case in Belgium comes as the Israeli government comes under increased scrutiny in Europe. Earlier this week, French sheep farmer and celebrity anti-globalization activist José Bové traveled to the Middle East and declared Israel to be an apartheid state. Raphael Kraft reports from Paris.
José Bové has been arrested by Israeli forces in the town of El Khader in the West Bank this afternoon during a peace march with Israeli peace activists. A dozen of Israeli peaceniks and members of other French associations accompanying José Bové were also arrested. The leader of La Confédération Paysanne, the French anti-globalization movement, had started a visit to Israel and the Palestinian-occupied territories last Saturday to speak for equality of rights in Palestine and what they say is colonization and repression perpetrated by settlers and Israeli occupation forces. Several demonstrations had been held before he was arrested. José Bové, along with French association Droit Devant and a delegation of the French social movement, first demonstrated in front of the Israeli Ministry of Interior against the daily hindrance to the liberty of movement imposed on the Palestinian people. He then forced a checkpoint near Bethlehem to enter the occupied territories. On Monday, he made a visit to the Orient House in East Jerusalem for a tribute to Palestinian leader Faisal al-Husseini, in charge of Jerusalem affairs, who died at the end of last month. José Bové said the situation in the occupied territories was dramatic and added, along with other French associations, that they had been witnessing a programmed ethnocide against the Palestinian people during their visit to the occupied territories. A Free Speech Radio News interview scheduled for this afternoon was cancelled because he was behind the bars. José Bové is now under arrest and no one knows how and when he will be released. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Paris.
The federal death chamber in Terre Haute, Indiana, is empty today after yesterday's execution of convicted murderer Juan Raul Garza, the second federal execution in 8 days. Garza's execution and Timothy McVeigh's the week before brought a tremendous number of activists to the small Indiana town, both for and against the death penalty. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Rennie McKay spoke with activist Bill Pelkey of Alaska, whose commitment to his cause set him apart from the throngs.
She was stabbed 33 times with a 12-inch butcher knife. In the courtroom, they had a section of the carpet that was under her body, showed how the knife had been shredded by the butcher knife. They had a picture of the hardwood floor, and underneath that carpet showed how the hardwood floor had been splintered.
Bill Pelkey is talking about the murder of his grandmother and the trial of Paula Cooper, the 15-year-old girl who killed her. Pelkey is from northern Indiana, but now lives in Alaska. He's returned to Indiana to speak out against the death penalty, but on the day of Paula Cooper's sentencing, he held a different point of view.
I would have put the switch in on the electric chair. I mean, I went in the courtroom the day she was sentenced to death, and when she came through the door, she was smiling at one of the guards, and I said, "You won't be smiling by the time this day's over with."
She was sentenced to die that day, but soon after, both Cooper and Pelkey were, in a sense, reborn. It happened for Bill Pelkey at the steel factory where he worked.
The way that I did was by praying for love and compassion, and that brought forgiveness, which brought healing. And forgiveness is something like just lifting a weight off your shoulders. I mean, I knew I was a different person when I left work that night than the person that went to work.
Pelkey has since joined a group called Murder Victims for Reconciliation and has met many people dealing with tragedy.
People told me I was crazy for forgiving Paula Cooper for killing my grandmother. And my response always was, forgiving Paula Cooper did more for me than it did for Paula Cooper. It freed me. If you hang on to that anger and you hang on to that rage, it'll become like a cancer and it'll destroy you. And we've seen it happen over and over again to victim family members that cannot forgive. And it destroys them. I mean, the perpetrator's bullet gets more than one person in that family.
As for Paula Cooper, she wasn't executed because of a change in Indiana law which raised the minimum age of a person who can be executed. Pelkey has visited her 9 times and says she's a changed person.
She was raised with severe child abuse, and she knew one thing well, and that was hate. After the fact of the murder and her going to jail, people did show her love and compassion. She responded to that, and she's a different person today.
Pelkey arrived in Terre Haute driving a 1965 Eastern Trailways bus. The bus is named Abolition Movement.
Well, we bought it to be a symbol of the movement. But unfortunately, it's become symbolic of the movement because quite often it's broken down and not going anyplace. But it's been performing pretty well lately, and so has the abolition movement.
On the way into Terre Haute for Timothy McVeigh's execution, the abolition movement blew a tire. In Terre Haute, I'm Rennie McKay for Free Speech Radio News.
Execution without the benefit of trial and torture are just two of the human rights violations common in Burundi. Burundi is a small country of some 6 million people that lies at the epicenter of the regional conflict in the African Great Lakes region, which has so far drawn in at least 7 other neighboring nations as combatants. In Burundi, the civil war has raged since 1993. More than 200,000 people have been killed in the conflict, which pits the Tutsi-dominated government forces against the mainly Hutu rebels. As so often, it is the non-combatant civilian population which bears the brunt, especially in the field of human rights abuses. Rupert Cook reports.
Early evening in Burundi's capital, Bujumbura. As the monsoon rain drums down, people run to take refuge off the streets, in the nearest public buildings. In this part of town, the mosque, or one of the ramshackle bars, which sell warm beer and roasted goat. Yet it could also be a metaphor for Burundi's crisis today, where everybody has at some time been forced to seek sanctuary from forces beyond their control. Nowhere more so than in the often seemingly arbitrary violation of Burundians' human rights. Extrajudicial arrest and execution, torture and the expulsion of whole communities from their homes are just some of the abuses inflicted on Burundian civilians. Tracy Dexter is country representative for international NGO Africare.
Public institutions and particularly the justice system are very, very weak. And you have the military, which I would say is not well enough trained there's some structural institutional problems that I think contribute to the fact that abuses are allowed to happen, and that sort of the culture of wielding power without accountability continues. I mean, that's part of it. There remains in Burundi a low level of information among the entire population about the fact that they have rights. So there isn't really a much of a lobby or a resistance to certain abuse, which, you know, then goes unnoticed, unpunished.
In a country so racked by war and civil conflict, it's not just the government which is a frequent violator of the most basic human rights. Much of the country is at times controlled and terrorized by the rebels. Yet there are increasing calls for accountability. Joseph Mujiji is Secretary General of Ligue Teka, Burundi's most prominent and longest-standing human rights NGO.
There are arbitrary detentions, that's true. People are forcibly disappeared, and we don't see much effort to stop this phenomenon. People will say they don't know. Everyone uses the war as the defense. But during the war, the right to life must remain sacred. The right not to be tortured must be sacred. I think there should be an effort to avoid arbitrary detentions and disappearances, because they will have to answer to the international community, because the international community treaties have been ratified. They can't get away from that. So we're waiting for them. We have to take action. We have to take it to the Commission for Human Rights to put pressure on the Burundian government. Whatever the situation, we have to make sure that concrete measures are taken, and especially that those responsible for human rights abuses are punished.
The Burundian government concedes that human rights violations are a serious problem. However, it argues that its extraordinary circumstances as a country racked in civil war are a mitigating factor. Eugene Nindorera is Burundi's Minister for Human Rights.
Even me, as a member of the government, I'm critical because we have to speak out about what's happening, but sometimes we don't have the means. When you're in a war situation, when people are using mortars against certain neighborhoods in the city, you can't react with flowers. We have to use firearms. We have to use violence, legitimate violence, to confront the situation. So, okay, I think that whoever is critical, that's perfectly normal, because the situation isn't very good. There are effectively human rights abuses, but the criticism has to be objective. There shouldn't be exaggeration in what's reported, and then also one shouldn't ignore the constraints, the reality in which we're living. When we speak of human rights in the U.S., you can't expect Burundi to react in exactly the same way when it's facing the current situation.
While Burundi's conflict situation has undoubtedly precipitated many of the most extreme human rights abuses, there's also the problem of a deeply entrenched culture which has systematically discriminated against women. Tracy Dexter from NGO Africare.
A woman, first of all, in the formal system, doesn't have certain rights within the family, and in the informal system really is expected to do all the work in the home and really not present herself too much outside of the home. There's the problem of women being ignorant of their right to physical integrity, and so I think violence against women is very widespread. And there's just not much lobby against it. In the reproductive sphere, there's also a very low level of recognition that a woman has the right also to control her body and her reproductive schedule. So another sort of abuse is just in the sense of giving birth and giving birth and giving birth, and then also having a very hard physical life.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rupert Cook in Bujumbura, Burundi.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.